The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Patrick Gibbons and today I'm joined by Michael Simmons and James Heal. So the reaction to yesterday's UK and EU summit continues. Yesterday's Coffeehouse Shots on the deal went out before the press conference that Keir Starmer gave with European Council President Antonio Costa and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. It's worth just hearing a little bit of what they had to say at the conference.
But the message we are sending to the world today is equally, if not more, important. It is a message that at a time of global instability and when our continent faces the greatest threat it has for generations, we in Europe stick together.
Ladies and gentlemen, Britain is back on the world stage, working with our partners, doing deals that will grow our economy and putting more money in the pockets of working people. In the last 2 weeks alone, we've delivered trade deals with India and the US. And that means jobs saved, jobs created, more growth, and a huge vote of confidence in this country.
James, that was Starmer announcing that Britain was back on the world stage. I felt it was striking yesterday that while the EU leaders spoke a lot about the friendship and allyship between Britain and the EU and contrasted this relationship against the backdrop of global instability, Starmer was keen to place this deal in the context of other trade deals with the US and India. Is that Starmer showing sensitivity around the Brexit issue?
I think it shows a couple of things. I mean, one is, as you say, Patrick, sensitivity. The other, I think, perhaps is, you know, is obviously the way in which the sequencing has occurred, you know, coming after the India and America deals. So he's happy to like sort of build us into sort of three deals in 2 weeks. That's been something part of Labour's messaging. I think also, in fairness, you know, you've got to look at where their sort of world focus is. The European Union sees everything through that lens. Mm. Starmer has dealing with a variety of global conflicts. And of course, you know, Europe is just one element. Now, it's an element he clearly values very seriously, which is why he gave his longstanding ally, perhaps his first friend in Parliament, Nick Thomas-Simmons, responsibility for the negotiations in the Cabinet Office, rather than David Lammy, who traditionally the Foreign Office would have had those negotiations. So I think it's a variety of a couple of things. As I think Labour has been caught a bit of a trap on this, I'd say, which is that on the one hand, they want to big it up as a really big win. On the other hand, they want to downplay its sort of significance in terms of marking any kind of great realignment. So there's a difficult sort of narrative there, but equally for their opponents, what the challenge is to sort of try and take the wins while obviously disdaining the sellouts, or if you want to call it that, or the negotiations that come with that. So everyone's a bit of a balancing act on all of it. But I mean, what's quite striking, I think, is the deal was a little less than we first thought when we first talked about this yesterday. And actually, I think that, you know, some commentators and some of them, they will be even saying, you know, why haven't we gone further on all this? There's a report today in the Times that one of the issues for the fishing deal being made from 4 years to 12 years, so 12 years in which the current deal gets extended, was because the French reportedly saw Keir Starmer's comments about a youth mobility scheme on Saturday and therefore thought they could go for more. Those comments were about a youth mobility scheme. Obviously, that leads to the question, which is, hang on a sec, if you're going to have a huge fuss about fish, you know, you may as well have just gone for the youth mobility scheme as well. Just to say also, it's quite striking, I think, that for all the technical stuff, it's clearly the fishing element that's cut through most today. Mm. As we talked about yesterday, you know, fishing, it contributes little in the way of HMRC tax revenue, but actually it's hugely important, significant value. I think the More in Common polling before the deal showed that it was the second issue that people most considered a Brexit betrayal. And, you know, I think there's an economist's famous rule of politics, which is never go to war with a profession that's depicted in a children's picture book. Labour first did that with the farmers, now with the fishermen. I mean, it seems to be a bit of a habit to go after highly visible targets. So I think although there'll be lots of discussion about important stuff like the emissions trading scheme, which obviously potentially has huge ramifications for UK industrial policy, and there's still a lot not known, I think the fishermen is going to be the key thing that sort of cuts through over the next couple of days.
Yeah, Nigel Farage and Reform talked about Labour killing off the fishing industry, and Kemi Badenoch talked about surrender. Most would have expected Farage's criticism, but do you think this is also a tricky place for the Conservatives and for Kemi Badenoch?
Yes, certainly, because I think that for a couple of reasons. I think one of which, just as a small thing, maybe a bit criminology, but the Telegraph comments today, for instance, on their splash, they featured Boris Johnson, the top criticism, then Richard Tice, number two, and then Kevin Bott, number three. Kevin Baynott wasn't an MP when the Brexit battle was fought in 2016. She has less of a claim to that than others do, for instance. You know, she was not one of the Spartans in 2019. It's an interesting divide in her kind of inner circle between her and Alex Burkhardt, who voted with the government, versus Julia Lopez and Lee Rowley, who were so-called Brexit Spartans. Brexit is an important issue for Kevin Baynott, but it's less of her thing. Whereas, you know, Boris Johnson clearly, but because of his role in 2016 and 2019, has a much greater claim to being the sort of father of Brexit, if you will. And same with sort of Farage and obviously UKIP, given his role there. Given all of that, where do the Conservatives position themselves? Do they want to be the party of Brexit and keep talking about that? Or do they want to move forward? What they're trying to do, obviously, in terms of beating reform, given, you know, everyone says you can't out-reform reform, on that basis, they therefore want to talk about fiscal credibility, conservatism. They want to be the party of business again once more, and kind of a centre-right, slightly smaller state form in which they're sort of pro-business, and that's the kind of way they want to get back. The trouble for them is, of course, is that all business organisations, with the exception of the fishermen or those related to fishing industries, have come out and applauded the deal as an improvement of what the existing arrangements were. And so we had this press conference yesterday, which Kevin Baynott was asked about, you know, what would she change? And her line seemed to be that if she was elected, what she would do would open another reorganisation, which of course nobody particularly wants to have, even if they don't like this deal. I think the key thing which unites Leavers and Remainers is a sense of fatigue about talking about it. So yes, there'll be difficulties with Keir Starmer because of this deal. On the other hand, there's also them for Kevin Baynock. And as so much to be the case in politics right now, it seems to be Nigel Farage is the one who might potentially be the beneficiary of that.
And Michael, James talks about fishing being the issue that's cut through, at least so far in the media and with the public. But you've written on Coffee House, a blog about energy policy and an important change that you think has gone under the radar. Can you tell listeners a bit more about that?
Yeah, so, you know, as James just pointed out, you know, fisheries is a topic that cuts through. It gets people riled up. It's what a lot of the talk in the Brexit negotiations were about. But the government's obviously made this, you know, raw calculation. If you look at food and animal exports to the EU, they're worth something like 10 billion compared to the total size of the fishing industry of 1 billion. But if you look through the deal, energy, as you say, is what really stuck out to me. So much of this deal, as you guys were discussing yesterday, was not so much, oh, we will do this. It's various commitments to talk. And one of the commitments they've made is to look at us essentially rejoining or joining the European energy market. And this is basically because the EU wants us to harmonize on something called the carbon price. And this is like a price that gets traded on the markets, and it's basically it's a net zero measure. Essentially, it's to make it expensive to use carbon, and you trade these because it allows you to sort of offset your carbon if you're a high energy exporter. And the government says that this harmonization will be a good thing because the EU were about to bring in this sort of carbon border levy tax, and right now UK carbon prices are lower than in Europe, although they jumped 6% yesterday on the news. And the government says that by our carbon prices coming into line with the EU in future, it will save exporting businesses something like £800 million. However, what I was writing about this morning is on the same day as this deal, the ONS released an interesting piece of analysis, which can basically be described as why heavy industry in Britain is absolutely goosed. And they showed various statistics that we point out in Coffee House about how high energy intensive industries, their output has come down, you know, over the last few years drastically compared to UK manufacturing, which, believe it or not, on the whole is actually up slightly in terms of what it produces. And the conclusion they reached there is purely because of our energy prices. You know, as we've said, I think I've said on this podcast like five times before that we're paying something like 4 to 5 times more than America for industrial energy. Similarly, we're paying more than, you know, Germany and France. And if this country wants to be serious, if this government wants to be serious about having any form of rebuilt industrial strategy, the very first thing they need to do is to drastically cut costs. And you do that by changing our attitude to gas, changing you know, the net zero kind of commitments and I would say zealotry, and going big on in things like nuclear. And whilst rejoining some kind of EU deal does not necessarily stop us from doing that, it cedes control to Brussels. I think a lot of people, you know, energy analysts would make this point that it might just make it more difficult to do the things that we need to do to restart industry in this country if it's not aligned with the same goals that are held across Europe.
So is that what you're concerned about, that this could amount to sort of giving up policy to Brussels, basically?
Yeah, I mean, look, it is. I mean, we would be making a commitment to, you know, have our carbon pricing harmonized. It would essentially it gives up energy policy, really, if you're to have dynamic alignment with rules for the European energy market. And also, I believe it would be governed by the ECJ as well. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't do some sort of drastic measure that you think would cut costs here. Obviously, this is not something that's actually agreed in the deal. It's a commitment to look at this, but there's nothing to suggest that the government don't want to do this. And it does seem that the one motivation is avoiding this carbon border tax. But that was a tax that was only going to hit essentially exporters. It doesn't strike me as something that would affect British heavy industry generally. Mm-hmm. So it seems a bizarre win given the potential trade-offs. But it's also worth saying, just on energy policy in general, these areas are so complicated, so it's hard to predict the future. I just think it's something that should be given more attention as we all analyse this deal.
And just to say, I mean, I think the indicators are from Brussels that the EU is going to expand its emission trading scheme. So will the UK, for instance, have to expand it as well? And obviously back to politics, the narrative around Scunthorpe, which I think was a sort of real wake-up call for some Labour MPs, the danger is, of course, you therefore have heavy industry being affected by this energy cost, which, as Michael says, are five times higher here for electricity than they are for the US.
And James, you know, despite Michael's concerns, you did say at the end of yesterday's podcast that, you know, the current parliamentary Labour Party is actually much more pro-EU than it probably was even around the Brexit years. So despite Michael's concerns around energy, is this and the deal as a whole actually quite an easy sell for Starmer? And the pollster James Johnson was saying on X that based on some of his work with focus groups, that he just feels that nothing that doesn't amount to freedom of movement actually cuts through enough with the British public.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, at an elite level, so yesterday it was the meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party, one of the most packed meetings I recall, and it was such with excitement, there was an overspill room with a video link for people to watch the Prime Minister. PM came along, how he'd spend the wild Monday nights, and there were more than 24 questions were asked there, and it was mostly about people asking about Labour concerns on things like Gaza or welfare. The EU deal didn't feature much, and as I said, you know, yesterday when the time of recording, Joe White, who's the MP for Bassett Law, and Graham Stringer were the only two sitting Labour MPs who've criticised the deal publicly, to my knowledge. And the point is, those numbers have stayed the same. You know, people are relaxed about it. I think most Labour MPs, almost all of them, would have voted or campaigned for Remain in 2016. However, we're in the world we're in now, which is they've set the red lines, which is the manifesto, no return to the single market, customs union or free movement. They can't rejoin over this course of this parliament. They have to have a series of commitments to these regular meetings, these summits, etc. So why not use the wins they can win and try and play the cards as best they're dealt? And I think that there was really was just the sort of non-issue almost. I mean, I think some would like it to go a bit further, but they're quite happy with it. I think on the terms of the country, obviously there is the potential for a narrative to be used against Labour. I think there's enough in what we discussed in potentially a sort of betrayal narrative. There's also questions, I think, about competence. I mean, I was striking, I think, that the EU defence deal went a little bit less far than people were hoping for. And we're now going to have further talks on whether the UK can access the £150 billion defence fund, which obviously would be a huge win given the UK's strength in defence manufacturing. But right now, I think that it's going to really not make a huge amount of difference in public opinion. And ultimately, by talking about a Brexit-coded issue and a Brexit-related issue, that might potentially benefit Farage at the expense of the Conservatives rather than hurt Labour, if that makes sense. Mm. Just to say also, I mean, the Prime Minister's most striking line, I think, from last night was when he said that the focus of the next 4 years was going to be about not making Nigel Farage Prime Minister in 2029. So again, it's the classic issue about, you know, oxygen in politics.
Yeah.
Farage and Starmer both want to talk about each other. They only feature each other in graphics. They cut Badenoch out of the conversation, and where that leaves the Conservatives remains to be seen, given we've just had a poll this morning putting the Conservatives down on just 16%. As one ex-Tory MP pointed out to me, we're only 6 points ahead of the Greens now, so fifth place, here we come.
And just to add as well on, you know, whilst I totally agree with James that the broader public essentially lost interest in all in sort of Brexity things, I think one part of the country that is very happy about this is the City of London and the Bank of England. You know, on the back of the India trade deal and the US trade deal, we had Andrew Bailey, the governor of the Bank of England, essentially saying, all well and good, but get us back aligned with Europe if you're serious about growth. Now, this deal is unlikely to do anything major. I think it's estimated to bring in something like £9 billion, which is about twice the size of the India deal, but still quite small. But it's something that the Bank of England has expressly been calling for. And I think if you speak to people in the city and business leaders who do business internationally, the big thing that they talk about is not so much the specifics of regulations and what might be, you know, agreed to in paper. It's about resetting relationships. And I think whatever your view of Brexit and how Starmer is dealing with this, one thing does seem to have changed, and we do seem to have a friendlier relationship, and people in the city are happy about that, even if fishermen are not.
I think the most striking thing is how much it was dominated the discussion yesterday in terms of the Tory press reaction from those who fought the war in 2016. And this morning I was watching Priti Patel on Talk TV and how animated she was. It was so striking to say how vexed and infuriated and passionate and lucid she was talking about, you know, yesterday. And sort of, I mean, it's rare someone managed to make Mike Graham look like a sort of Liberal Democrat, but Priti Patel was on. But the point is that that was an animating cause. And right now, I think a lot of Conservatives have at heart. For those who fought that in 2016 is a really big animating factor. But I think a lot of MPs in Parliament now, of course, think about the churn we've had since the past 10 years, three different elections, massive turnover at each of those. I think that Parliament, there's a sense that, yes, we'll have the statement today at 12:30, but I don't think we're expecting huge fireworks. And for Starmer, there might be a sense perhaps of, you know, future negotiations, you can go a little bit further.
And just finally, Michael, on the sequencing, you know, we've had the US, we've had India, we've had the EU, as you mentioned, and Rachel Reeves, as a result, has said this morning that the UK is in a better place than any other country in terms of trade. You know, the EU deal, by some estimates, will only add, you know, 0.3% to British GDP. But yeah, are these incremental aspirational wins, or, you know, does it show a lack of ambition? Has the government found its groove with these trade deals?
I think she's right that, like, it does look like we're on the face of it that we're starting to create momentum, and, you know, you're certainly not hearing of other countries doing deals in this kind of, you know, spitfire way that we are. But I think the reason for that is you look at the substance of these things, which there is not much substance. So essentially, one way to look at it is, we've rushed into specifically the America deal as a sort of damage limitation exercise. So yes, we've got that deal before anyone else. And yes, that means that Rachel Reeves can shout about these things. But I think other countries might say to you, well, it's all well and good being first, but, you know, we never would have negotiated so softly. So I think she can take that win. But when you look at it, it's because there isn't much substance.
And of course, you know, it's great sort of politically to say we were the first at the queue. Actually, in terms of negotiations, often being first, you don't get much advantage. It's actually a downside, because sometimes people want to watch and see and learn from best practices in terms of negotiations. So it enables the government to say something. Yes, we're signing the deal, we've changed it around, etc. And it helps improve Rachel Reeves' fortunes, who I think at minus 40 was the last time I checked, was the most unpopular mainstream politician in Britain. But I don't think, frankly, it's going to make a huge difference in terms of moving the dial either economically or politically.
Well, Rachel Reeves has turned her attention to the Gulf countries following President Trump. So perhaps a £400 million jet is on its way to the British government. Well, thank you, James. Thank you, Michael. And thank you for listening to Coffee House Shots.